It is the great reset for our week that on the first day of the week we gather to praise Jesus the Christ as Lord of all and to remember the sacrifice, which is the greatest sacrifice and service of all. It defines who we are, defines how we're to live, and we're so grateful that we can do this together, and we welcome all who are here. Homer, the well-known Greek poet, wrote, "No man of woman born, coward or brave, can shun his destiny." If ever there was a man, period, and certainly ever was a man in the record of the Bible who had a destiny, it was Moses. We think of Moses, we think of a great leader. The man who spoke with God, the man who spoke for God, and the man through whom God worked some of the most stupendous supernatural wonders ever on earth. And a man who had a supreme goal and purpose to lead Israel out of bondage to freedom to the promised land. But when we think of Moses, and we think of his destiny, do we always think about the path to that? Today we're going to take a look at Moses. Not the Moses who stands in the court of Pharaoh or on the shores of the Red Sea or at the pinnacle of Mount Sinai. We're going to look at Moses at the well. Turn with me to the book of Exodus, where in the first two chapters we learn the background of this man and the foundation for this most important Old Testament event that is not just important in forming the Israelite nation, but in being the template of the redemption story, and that is of all humans being freed from sin by Jesus Christ. As you read the words of Exodus in the first chapter, you can almost hear the cries of the Hebrews. At first, Israel, the man Israel, and his sons and their families had migrated to Egypt because of the great famine in the land of Canaan. And there, one of his sons, Joseph, through a series of very unusual and trying events, had become the prime minister of the land and was leading Egypt in preserving grain and preparing for the future lean years. And there, Joseph, in his high position, was able to provide for his family. And Joseph's family was in a very honored position. But then a new regime, many, many, many years later, centuries later, came into existence, and they had a different disposition toward the Hebrews, who were now not merely this overgrown family of 12 sons and their wives and children, but now they are a race of people, numbering in the hundreds of thousands, most likely. And because they had multiplied so greatly, the new Pharaoh feared their numbers, and so he oppressed them with slavery, making bricks and forming mortar for the building projects, laboring hard in the fields. But that wasn't enough. They kept multiplying, and so he ordered the midwives to slay the male children that were born to try to reduce their numbers and especially reduce the warrior class in the years ahead. That was not successful. And so he ordered the Hebrew parents to expose their male babies by throwing them into the river, to destroy them in the Nile. Nobody knows how many little boys perished in that. We only know about one family that matters. In Exodus chapter 2, we read starting in verse 1. "Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. And she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank." Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23 tells us that the parents were not afraid of the king's command. We know later in the Old Testament that the names of these parents were Jochebed and Amram. And they were willing to risk their lives to find a way to preserve the life of their son. And of all the people to stroll by and find this baby, it was a princess of Egypt, a daughter of Pharaoh. And when she looked in the ark, she saw the child and had compassion on him. He was crying. And so she wanted to keep him and protect him as her own. We read in Exodus chapter 2 involving the older sister who was watching over the baby. In verse 7, then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse this child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because she said, "I drew him out of the water." We can see the hand of God in all this, can we not? Knowing how this thing ends up, that Moses was preserved and that he was provided for and protected, and that he maintained a link to the mother that was his Hebrew biological mother, but now was afforded a rearing in Pharaoh's family. Yes, this baby boy was spared for a very special purpose. And so we're told about his training living in Pharaoh's house. There have been pieces of fiction, including children's movies that have been made that somehow made it out, and even back in the 1950s with Cecil DeMille and so forth, that somehow Moses could have been the ruler of Egypt. That's not going to happen. First of all, he's a Hebrew. Second of all, the lineage of the Pharaoh went through the son, not through a daughter to a son. And so that's not likely to have happened. But though he's saved here, and he becomes Pharaoh's daughter's son, and as a result, he's going to have the best of everything, food and clothing and a home. And this is the first time that we peer over into the New Testament, because I want us to consider several passages from Acts chapter 7 where Stephen, the evangelist, is proclaiming the gospel in a defense against the Sanhedrin Council, and he recounts the history of Israel, including a lot about Moses. And so we pair together Acts chapter 7 with the early chapters of Exodus. And this is what Stephen has to say. At this time, Moses was born, and he was beautiful in God's sight, and was brought up for 3 months in his father's house. And when he was exposed, Pharaoh's daughter adopted him and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. And he was mighty in his words and deeds. Some of this we see in the book of Exodus, but there are some details here that are unique to the Moses story. We have additional insight because of Acts chapter 7. And here we are told that he was given first-class education, and that this man was loaded with ability. He even was mighty in his deeds. In other words, there was a way that he carried himself and the way that he did things and accomplished things that was impressive. But this man, at a crucial point in his life, had a decision. Though he had escaped the fate of living as a slave, let alone being put to death, exposed, and though he had all the earthly pleasures and luxuries at his fingertips, Moses, well, something was eating at him. We're told in Exodus chapter 2 and in verse 11 what it was. One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens. His people. He knew he really belonged with the Hebrews. And he saw how much they were suffering. And in particular, something, well, set him off. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people, twice in that text. It identifies Moses and his people. Well, Acts 17 adds additional information there. Acts 7 and verse 23 says, when he was 40 years old, we know exactly how old he was. He's 40 years old. It came into his heart to visit his brothers, the children of Israel. He's full grown. He's in the prime of his life. By the way, this is not the part of the Old Testament where people are living to be 500, 600, and 700 years old and older. Now, their lifespans are about what ours are, roughly. And so he's at that prime of life. Do you remember 40? Some of you haven't hit that yet. I mean, at 40, I could do anything. I thought I could, and I could do a lot. I mean, that's prime, isn't it? And at the age of 40, he was moved by how his Hebrew brethren were suffering. And he had to make a decision. Is he going to be an Egyptian? Or is he going to be a Hebrew? Hebrews chapter 11 tells us what his choice was. We're in this list of the faithful from the Old Testament. We're told in Hebrews chapter 11, starting in verse 24, by faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. He understood the ramifications of his roots, his true identity as a Hebrew. He knew that he was among the called out people of God. And though the people of God were currently under oppression, he knew that they were the people of God. And that no matter how things looked on earth, the superior choice was to side with God's people and to be among his people, no matter what the cost. And it's this decision that caused him to act and to really fully cast his lot with the Hebrews. When he goes out that day and he saw his Hebrew brother suffering, we're told in verse 12, he looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. At this crossroads, he makes a bold decision and he takes a bold action. Isn't that what you want in a leader? Boldness, initiative, strength. Stephen tells us more. When we go back over to Acts chapter 7, Stephen tells us in verse 24, and seeing one of them being wronged, he defended the oppressed man and avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. He supposed that his brothers would understand that God was giving them salvation by his hand. Ah, Stephen enlightens us via the Holy Spirit. Now we understand what's going on inside of Moses. He is attempting to seize his destiny. After all, who else could do this? What a better deliverer of the Hebrew people than this man who was a Hebrew by birth but had been raised as an Egyptian, who was well versed in the ways of the Egyptians. One who had been educated and trained, who had developed to be a person mighty in speech and mighty in deeds. And Moses was incensed at how his brethren were being treated, and so he decided to side with them and stand with them and oppose the evil Egyptians. And he acts. I mean, this deliverer has stepped forward with confidence in his heart, and he's got fire in his eyes. This deliverer was ready for this mission. But the Hebrew people and God were not ready. Looking here at Acts chapter 7, verse 25, says there, he supposed that his brothers would understand that God was delivering. But the end of that verse says, but they did not understand. They didn't see it that way. They didn't see his act as the trigger event to begin their deliverance from bondage. And God didn't see it that way either. When we go back over to Exodus chapter 2, and we consider what the passage there records, after striking this Egyptian and hiding his body, when he went out, verse 13, the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, why do you strike your companion? He answered, who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid. Excuse me. Then Moses was afraid and thought, surely the thing is known. And when Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian. Where does this leave Moses? He thinks he's the instrument for their deliverance. He rises up to defend them. He injects himself to be their arbitrator, and they reject him. And then his family of raising the Egyptians in Pharaoh's household, when they learn that he has struck and killed an Egyptian, Pharaoh wants to execute him. He's got nobody. He's a man without a people. And he's a man without a land because he has to run. And as a result, it appears to Moses, he's a man without a destiny. And thus we read that when he comes to Midian, according to Acts 7, at this result or retort, Moses fled and became an exile in the land of Midian. And we're told that he was sitting there by a well. He'd fled for his life. He'd left Egypt. He's running from Pharaoh. He's been rejected by the Israelite brethren. What he thought was his life was behind him. And he went eastward. Where's Midian? Middle of nowhere. The edge of civilization at the time. Matter of fact, it's still, this part of the world is still a very remote place. Not very populated. He went, I mean, that's a long way to go on foot. He went as far as he could go until he could look over his shoulder and not have to worry, to where nobody would find him. And he sat down at a well. That statement there in Exodus 2, at the end of that sentence, and he sat down by a well. It deserves a pause. Because of everything that went before this, all the events, because of all the expectations that had been dashed. And there he sat at the well. What's he going to do now? Where is he headed now? What's the purpose of his life now? There he sat at the well. It's interesting how that the human predicament keeps popping up in various art forms through the years. And so pardon me for my highbrow references to art. First of all, this incident reminds me of the lyrics of Dwight Yoakam. I'm 1,000 miles from nowhere. Time don't matter to me. I'm 1,000 miles from nowhere. And there's no place I want to be. And then there are the Beatles. Nowhere man. He's a real nowhere man. sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody. Doesn't have a point of view, knows not where he's going to. Isn't he a bit like you and me? Have you ever been at a well in Midian? Life didn't turn out the way you thought it was going to turn out. The plans you had just disintegrated. You thought you knew where you were going. You thought you knew what you were going to accomplish, and then you're just completely lost. Events unfold the way you thought they would not. May have to do with longing to be married one day and then what happens in that marriage. Or having plans for children and then what happens with those children or grandchildren. Or what your job or career plans were and expectations were and objectives were. And it didn't turn out that way. Or your retirement years, what you dreamed that they would be. Or your health, or your finances. Or even, yes, even this, your service to God, what you thought it would be and how you thought it would go. It's not happened that way. Even though you may have had good intentions in any of those things, like Moses, you may have even thought you were doing the will of God. But like Moses, you were blocked, thwarted, detoured. And you ask yourself, what next? What's going to happen now? Where do I go from here? It's at this juncture in the life of Moses, when he's sitting there at that well. And what a moment that was. That then he steps in to the next phase and into a life he never would have dreamed he would have lived. He stands up and he assists some young women who were the daughters of a man named Jethro. He helps them to water their flocks and to fend off others who were getting in the way. He meets this family and Jethro gives one of his daughters for him to marry. And then he works as a shepherd for Jethro, his father-in-law. And we're told in Exodus chapter 2 and in verse 22, speaking of his wife, she gave birth to a son and called his name Gershon, for he said, I've been a sojourner in a foreign land. For 40 years, Moses lived that way. He lived in Midian as a shepherd in the middle of nowhere. 40 years that way. And after that much time of wandering around in that dusty wasteland, shepherding those stinky sheep, one day he saw a bush that would not stop burning. And he heard a voice unlike any other. And as they say, the rest is history. We're left all sort of wise regarding this period of Moses' life. Why did he end up as a shepherd in Midian when God's going to use him to deliver the Israelites? Why end up doing that dead-end job in the middle of nowhere? Why so many years in obscurity? 40 years, that's a long time. Why doing seemingly nothing that would promote the deliverance of Israel? Now, those are a lot of good questions for which we have very few answers. But Moses' experience and example here and what God was doing with him and what God was not doing with him provides a lot of insights. So here are some observations about the Midian well and Moses' experience there. First of all, God's plans are often different than ours. Moses had the wrong plan for freeing the Israelites. He thought that he could initiate it, and he would initiate it with this violent act. God's method would be different 40 years later. Egypt would get the punishment they deserve. Egypt would be delivered a just blow. And the Israelites would be redeemed from bondage. But God would do it His way. God would act in such a way as the true and living God through signs and wonders that only could be ascribed to God, not some fiery insurrectionist. Yeah, Moses was used, but wow, that's how you deliver people. Hold your rod out. Whoa. No, it's God that's going to deliver Israel, not Moses. No matter how much we believe in a thing and how much good we see in it and how hard we may work to carry it out, it doesn't mean God wants that. A lot of times we so think something and so believe something, we think it's God's will. Oftentimes, it's the opposite. And we see that God's timing is different than ours. Moses was right in thinking that God would deliver His people. Actually, that was a promise made to Abraham 4 centuries before. But he was wrong, not only in the method, but also the timing of it. Galatians 4, verse 4 talks about how that in the fullness of time that the Son of God came. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 11 talks about God acting in the beautiful time. God does everything beautiful in its time. Beautiful there doesn't mean it looks pretty. It means appropriate and perfect and complete. God's timing is just right. That's what that means. My mother was a biscuit master. Absolutely. And you think that's her son, he's prejudiced? No. Every person who ever tasted a morsel of her biscuits, their eyes just flipped. Okay, that was hyperbole. But she had a breakfast biscuit and a dinner biscuit. And the breakfast biscuits were just perfection. And the evening biscuits, the dinner biscuits, they were called angel biscuits for good reason. I never once saw my mom follow a recipe or use a kitchen timer. She'd been making those biscuits since she was a girl. And she would get the flour out and the shortening out and all the things, and she would roll it, and it was just all done with her hands. She'd pop them in those pans. She'd put them in that oven, and she'd walk by that oven, and she was a short little thing, and she'd get up and look in that oven like that. She knew exactly how much time by looking at them. She didn't need a timer. And it was rare that they ever were underdone or overcooked. It was rare. There were a couple, and boy, did she get upset when they were. Somehow she got distracted or something, but almost every time, those biscuits were perfection for the palate. And you didn't tell her when they were done, and you didn't tell her how to make those biscuits. Her timing was perfect. God knows what He's doing. And His timing is perfect. And we need to have faith in that. And understand that not being in the know is part of serving God. Look at all that Moses didn't know. We have the full picture. We knew where this thing was going and what God would do with him. And when Moses sat there at that well, he couldn't have envisioned what we know that happens in Exodus 3 and 4 and 8 and 10 and 20. He couldn't know that. And at that point, when he sat there at that well, he couldn't even dream of those things. Whatever happened. While being a Christian involves all kinds of privileges and blessings, including a lot of revelation from God through the scriptures, we're not permitted to be completely in the know. You go to the airport down here, and you can go in there and go to the ticket counter, and you can go to the restrooms and go to the shops and get something to eat and get one of those pretzels or whatever you want to do. And you go to your gate and all that. There's one place you can't go. You can't go to the control tower. You get on the airplane. You can go and get a seat. You can buy a seat in first class. You can buy one in coach. You can go to the lavatory. You can go up and down the aisles. There's one place you can't go. You can't go in the cockpit. We're never allowed in the control tower. We're never allowed in the cockpit. And we have to be content with not knowing what's going to happen in some of the things of our lives. And sometimes we see here that we have to wait and develop, even ripen, before we're ready for a task. Evidently, God thought that 40 years herding sheep was a better preparation for Moses than 40 years of Egyptian high education. It's odd, isn't it? As the Exodus continues, the next few chapters, how that when God came to him and spoke through that burning bush and called him to go to Egypt and command Pharaoh to release his people, it's odd how this works. Because before, 40 years before, Moses was saying, according to Stephen, "I'm ready, God, I'm ready." God was saying, "No, you're not." But here in Exodus 3 and 4, Moses, when he's called to do this explicitly by God, Moses says, "Oh, I'm not ready. I'm not the man for this job." And God said, "No, you are." Moses said in Exodus 3, verse 11, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" We're 40 years before. He thought he was the top of the list. You know the difference here in these two situations, this 40-year period, one end and the back end, front end and the back end? The difference is confidence and opportunity. When something doesn't work out or we don't get the opportunity we were looking for, maybe it's because we weren't ready for that. You see, we confuse confidence with preparation and being ready. We humans think that confidence is everything. "I'm confident I can do this, and I know I can do this. I'll tackle this." Oftentimes, we can have all the confidence in the world, and God doesn't think we're ready for something. Case in point, Moses. But what happened when he's 80? When he and probably nobody else thought he'd be a fit candidate for this job, God says, "Now I want you to do this. I'm giving you the opportunity to do this now." You see, opportunity is more important than confidence. Confidence is something that we muster up. Opportunity is a door that God opens. And following in the footsteps of Moses, some of the best things we can do in God's kingdom is not when we're brimming with confidence, but rather God has opened a door in front of us. And so all that matters is if God's opening up a door, is that I step through it and lean on Him. And we understand here from Moses' experience that how we handle living in Midian is equally as important as that destiny that may await us. You know, the best thing for Moses to do, the only thing for Moses to do as he sat there at that well, was just to get up and go on with life. Not a bad motto. Just get up and go on with life. So what does he do? He finds a job. He gets a wife. He starts a family. And he just works. Nothing fancy there. That's what Moses, the man who has a long shadow across the whole Bible, that's what he did for 40 years. He just lived a life. And evidently, though he had no confidence in his leadership ability, the way he did respond to God and the way he kept responding to God and the way he ultimately responded to God, he had not forgotten about God. He maintained his faith. And while it might be true that the experience of fleeing to Midian and living in Midian broke his spirit, because he's not a spirited man anymore, but it is clear that it forged his character. Because now the Moses that you see, he's not the ambitious, rash, hot-tempered man that he was before. He's seasoned, wiser, more humble, and better qualified to be a leader. Remember this. Everything in life is a test. Remember school? Got a test in 2 weeks. You're like, oh, okay. I can ride here for a little while. It's okay. Everything, every day, is a test. Including those times when nothing seems to be happening much. Including those times when it appears that maybe we're between missions. We're between big events. Including those times when we don't know what's ahead. Sitting at the well and shepherding in Midian was a test for Moses. And he passed. Because in 40 years, God came calling. During those Midian periods in our lives, all kinds of bad things can happen. We can grow bitter, impatient, cynical. We can despair. We can turn to immorality. We can indulge the flesh. We can lose our faith in God. But good things can also happen at Midian. You can grow in character. You can develop a better understanding of self, better understanding of God. You can develop a stronger faith. How will you handle the time when you find yourself sitting at a well in Midian? Things didn't turn out the way you thought they would. And this is where our sermon this morning, by looking at the example of Moses and his experiences, tie into last Sunday's sermon about God's providence. For you see, even when you cannot see what lies ahead, even when you can't find direction, if you've committed yourself to be God's follower, you've committed yourself to be among the people of God, He does have a plan, a mission, and a destiny for you. As we explored Romans 8, that key hinge statement in verse 28 last week, and we know, Paul writes, we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to His purpose. Now, if I could go back in time and sat down beside Moses at that well. I hope I have enough tact not to quote that scripture. You know, we talked about this last week. I mean, those things can sound trite. It's like you saw this car wreck and this guy gets run off the road and he crashes his car and his car's all busted up and you walk up and he's bleeding and he's got an arm out of joint and you walk up and you're like, well, you're alive and they're going to fix you up good as new and this car's going to look great when they finish with it. You don't say that. You know, we got to work through these things. We got to absorb these things and navigate them. These are not little statements to slap on a difficult situation. These are anchors to attach to that keep us from drifting. We know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to His purpose. You might be saying, I don't know what God wants me to do. I don't know where I'm headed. I don't know what He's going to do with me. It's all right. You don't have to know those things. You just have to know God. Which means you're not wasting time anywhere. Even if you are a Midian, you're of use to Him right where you're at. And you can mature and grow in Him right where you're at. And you can be perfected in whatever you're doing. Because God works that way for His people. And once Moses, per Hebrews 11, once Moses put himself, cast himself with God's people, he had that assurance. Though he may not have been feeling it at the well. For those who trust God and obey Him, there are no dead ends, even in Midian. So the next time you're at a well in Midian, remember you're in good company. Moses is sitting right next to you. And remember that in order for him to rendezvous with his destiny, he had to go to Midian for 40 years. And look how God was still with him. And look how God eventually used him and draw strength from that. And don't despair, but believe. Thank you for your consideration of all those things. Our brother Dave has another hymn for us to sing together. And if you have not cast your lot with the people of God, then you are called by the gospel of Christ. He has sacrificed himself to pay for every sin in your life. And if you would become his disciple, then you can be forgiven as you confess your faith in Jesus as the Christ, the Son of God. Turn from those sins and be baptized into Christ. You can join with the people of God on that journey of the most incredible destiny ever. And that is to be a person of God now and to look for that reward in that heavenly country and that heavenly city where our true destiny lies. If you need to respond to the call of the gospel, won't you do that as we stand and sing?